This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. A drug felony used to disqualify a person from access to food stamps for life, no matter how many years had passed, how long they were drug-free, or how long they followed parole. Cheryl Ash wanted to change that, and after 6 years of trying, she helped make it happen. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. 3881. Joining me now is one of the major advocates for the current change in the law that expands SNAP eligibility to those with prior drug felonies, Cheryl Ash. Cheryl, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
So the work that we'll be talking about today is advocacy that you've been steeped in for the last 6 years. So before we jump into it, can you help us rewind to the beginning? You've been an advocate helping ex-offenders reenter the community for years. What brought you to this work?
Well, my church had a program they belonged to called Companions on the Journey, and it matched one church with one inmate coming out of prison. And, we belonged to this organization before it folded, probably 4 years, about 4 years. We started around 2002. And we worked with about, I'd say, four, maybe five people coming out of prison. And we basically walked with them, helping them come up with clothing, helping them find work. Someone, for instance, in our group, we had five people in the group, and one of the gentlemen would go play basketball with them. So we got each offender a membership to the Y. Another person had Notre Dame tickets and would take them to Notre Dame games. And I kind of did what I would call the social service things, helping them get to free clinics, et cetera, until they found a job. Well, when the recession came, beside those people, I started getting calls from other individuals saying, do I know where someone can get food? Because people were being laid off, their factories were closing, and they go and discover that they couldn't qualify for food stamps because 10 years earlier, 15 years earlier, they had a drug felony. So I started taking people around to food pantries. But you only get enough food for about 2 to 3 days if you're an individual from a food pantry. That meant I had to take people to 2 to 3 food pantries a week. So I would spend literally from about 12 o'clock to maybe 3:30 or 4 every afternoon, Monday through Friday, driving people to food pantries. And to be quite honest, I tell people it was for selfish reasons that I started to try to change the law. I got tired of in the winter sitting in the car with the engine running to stay warm, and in the summer with the engine running to stay cool if it was hot. And I just thought this law needs to be changed.
So what were some of the common challenges of reentry that you were helping people navigate, other than the ones that we're talking about, driving people to food pantries? What were some of the things you saw often?
What I saw often was employment. Many places just said they did not hire someone with a criminal record. Other times it would be a person trying to find a place to live. Because let's say, for instance, they were going to live with grandma, but grandma lived in subsidized housing. Well, subsidized housing wouldn't let anyone with a felony get into it. Medication was a big one. So you see, when people were in prison, they were getting their medicine. But when they got out of prison, they were often working at places that were low pay, and $8 an hour, $9 an hour. And by the time you subtract child support, by the time you subtract the taxes out of a $8 to $9 an hour job, they couldn't afford insurance. I remember one gentleman who had MS, and luckily I went to church with a lady who understood how to access drugs for free because his medicine was $4,000 a month. And without it, he couldn't even walk. So those were some of the challenges.
SNAP, which stands for Supplemental Nutrition Insurance Program, provides food assistance to low and no income people. It's a federal program, but distribution is done at the state level. Can you explain how people in Indiana apply for SNAP benefits?
Well, today you can simply go online and, for instance, if someone would go to Google on the internet and type in Indiana SNAP application, up will come the website. And then they simply go onto the website and it asks basic questions, age, how many people you're applying for, address. Then what it will do is it will ask you, do you want an in-person interview or a phone interview? Whichever you choose, they'll then send you information in the mail about the time for your appointment and what to bring with you. And what you bring with you are standard things like your Social Security card, your birth certificate, a government-issued ID. You'll need to bring your lease if you are renting someplace. If you're own your house, then you need to bring information showing you own your house. It asks you to bring, if you have children involved, it asks you to bring the children's Social Security cards, etc. And you have a short interview. It's probably not more than about 15 to 20 minutes. If you qualify, then approximately 30 days later, you would get a card in the mail, which is what you have. It looks like a credit card, and it simply, it's kind of like a debit card. You'll have a PIN number, so when you go to buy food, you just slide the card, put your PIN number in, and it will subtract it from your balance.
We're talking with Cheryl Ash, who advocated for a change in the law, in a law that stemmed from the 1996 Federal Welfare Reform Act, which barred people with felony drug convictions from receiving food stamps. Now, were there any stipulations there? What if someone had paid their debt to society, followed parole, or et cetera?
The law said you didn't get it for the rest of your life. I had run into people who, this law went into effect, I believe it was 1996 or 1997. Can't quite remember. But what I can tell you, there were people who in 1998 were arrested for a drug crime, did their time, and were never able to get food stamps again. Even for instance, there's a lady I know out of Fort Wayne. I met her through kind of advocating and asking people how the law was affecting them. She was on disability. She had a drug crime. She served her time. She did everything she was supposed to. She got off of probation. She was in a car accident. It left her disabled. She was getting $773, I believe, a month. But she couldn't qualify for food stamps because some 15 years earlier, she had committed a drug crime.
What was the argument for a lifetime ban from food stamps for these drug crimes?
That people would use their food stamps, sell them to buy drugs. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, okay? Perhaps a very, very small number of people do that. The vast majority of people do not misuse their food stamps. They don't buy drugs with it. But that was the reasoning behind denying people for the rest of their lives. So you had people who went through drug treatment. You had people who they only had one time that they had committed a drug crime. And here they are 15 or 20 years later and weren't able to get food stamps. But I'm going to tell you the really, really sad one, beside, for instance, the person who was on disability and couldn't get food stamps. They would tell you, oh, children can get it, but the parent can't. Yes and no. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by yes and no? You see, when you do food stamps, you look at the total household income. So if there's three people in the house, say a parent and two children, then the total household income is counted, but they only count two people. as far as in the formula. Well, what was happening is, and I saw that with several people, what happened was is you had a mom and a child. The mom, say, and child were total household income was $800 a month. Mm. But because they weren't counting the parent, that meant that the child was over income and therefore the child could not get food stamps. And that was happening to a lot of one child, one parent households.
You're located up in South Bend. What kinds of resources and food assistance are available for people going through reentry there?
Well, you know, of course, now we have SNAP. But before SNAP, we do have food pantries. The problem about a food pantry is it's canned goods, a lot of canned goods, high in sodium, high in syrup, sugary products. And some of the things you really need and to kind of have a healthy diet are dairy products and lean meats, because it's been shown that proper eating of lean meats and dairy products, et cetera, can help tamp down cravings, you know, and for the drug and for alcohol. And if you can tamp down the cravings and help people weather that better, then they don't have to worry about as much relapse.
Does it differ? And we've only got about 30 seconds left. Does it differ from in South Bend from what you might find in, say, a more rural community?
Oh, yeah. You see, rural communities, for instance, take a town like Lytus Ford, very small town. Mm. They don't have a food pantry, say. And the nearest food pantry might be 8 miles away. It might be 10 miles away. And remember, rural areas don't have buses. Mm. So people didn't, at least in South Bend, people can catch a bus to some food pantries.
Cheryl Ash is a retired longtime librarian and advocate for ex-offenders. And up next, we'll be back with Cheryl, as well as one of the women who helped her collect research that would help to make her case to lawmakers. As always, we would love your questions and comments on social media during our live conversation today. Do you have questions about how a bill becomes a law in Indiana, maybe, or the practical matters that go into making those changes to the law a reality? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about a change in the law that went into effect January 1st, a change that expanded the eligibility of SNAP benefits to those who had prior convictions of drug felonies. As always, we would love your questions or comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. And we're joined again by someone who helped make this happen, retired librarian and advocate for ex-offender Cheryl Ash, who joins us live today from WVPE in Elkhart. And we're also joined by Carolina Arroyo, the Associate Director of Undergraduate Studies and Director of Internships at the University of Notre Dame. Carolina, we're glad to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Cheryl, we spoke in the last segment about the challenges that come with barring people with prior drug felonies from food stamps. And for this segment, we're going to cover all the years that you worked on this before the bill passed in 2018. And again, it just went into effect last month. When you decided to try to change the law on this issue, where did you start?
Well, I'm going to be honest. I looked up the law. I originally wrote to every Indiana state senator, which goes to Indianapolis, and representatives, and I just told them about the problem people were having and suggested that they make a law. I found out later on that a state senator and all had put a law in. It didn't pass. Then what happened next is I realized I needed research, and I happened to hear about a program that they had at Notre Dame that was called the Gainey Grant Program. It gave grant money to a professor and students to do research. So I put my name in. I didn't get it. But luckily for me, one of the people at the Gainey Grant program really liked the idea, and she went and found me Catalina.
And Catalina, can you explain what kind of work the university's Center for Social Concerns does?
So most of the work that they do is involved with helping the community and primarily social justice issues. So I had found out about Cheryl's project and was very, very interested in meeting with her and discussing the project with her, because I thought this would be something that students in political science in the department that I work in would be very interested in trying to create and write a bill to actually turn it into a law. But more importantly, I saw it as something that could really benefit the community in a somewhat reliable and short amount of time. I guess it took longer than we anticipated, but it actually, as you know, happened.
How often do things like this work out? People bring things to you and you work on writing the bill and maybe getting it submitted. And then I guess how often do they actually become law?
Well, this is the first time I became involved in writing a bill. I have another project that's going to be coming up in the fall that's not related to this. But as I said, our students I work with only undergraduates, and they just were so excited when I sent the email out. We always had 2 to 4 students every semester work with us, and several of those students just continued until they graduated. So for me, it doesn't happen all that often, but I was thrilled that Cheryl was willing to work with me and a group of students.
I want to add why the students were so important. Okay. You know, I wanted to still help take people to food pantries because they needed food. And I was reaching the point where I would try to do research, and then I would try to take people to food pantries. I'm retired, and I was putting in 30 hours a week.
Goodness.
And so what was happening is I was having to choose between taking somebody for food or doing the research, and the research always lost out. So when the students came along, it was like I didn't feel guilty anymore and all not doing the research. And I just can't tell you how important what they did was.
And I should mention that they did the research and did receive academic credit. So we have a course that's called Research Apprenticeship, and the purpose is for students to work with a faculty member and learn how to do research. So I see it as a win-win for everyone. They were learning how to do research. They were researching a topic and an activity that they were extremely interested in, and they received academic credit for working with Cheryl.
I want to come back to something that we brought up in the first segment, this relation between good nutrition and relapse prevention. And that was one topic that you and the students took a look at, and it makes sense because that's part of the argument for getting this law changed. What did you find there?
Well, we looked at what was available at food pantries. We looked at different research and different papers that had been written about the relationship between nutrition and drug addiction and relapsing. We did put together a brochure about it But when we submitted it based on the need for healthy nutrition, that was not passed, and so we had to look at it in a different way.
And you also researched how other states were handling this issue. What did you find out there?
At the time that we started this, Indiana was one of nine states that accepted the federal law as it was written. At this time now, we are down to three states that continue to block SNAP benefits for drug offenders. And those states are West Virginia, Mississippi, and South Carolina.
And so,
I always laughingly say, when Texas passed the law, Indiana should feel ashamed.
And why is that?
Because Texas is known not to be super friendly to people with criminal records. And it's kind of known to be somewhat of a tough state when it comes to, shall I say, the law. Mm. But Texas passed this law. So did Georgia, which is another state that is known to be somewhat tough for things for ex-offenders. So all I'm saying is it was really sad that Indiana was one of the last states to pass this. You know, I also want to add, we talk about relapse. Well, you know, the students found out that at the time it was approximately $21,000 to keep a person in prison a year. Mm. But for a single person to get food stamps, okay, it was about $2,200 a year. So if we could keep with good nutrition one or two people from relapsing, you can see the savings the state would have.
We're talking with Cheryl Ash. She's a retired librarian and advocate for ex-offenders. We're also talking with Carolina Arroyo, the Assistant Director of Undergraduate Studies and Director of Internships at the University of Notre Dame. Cheryl, the students at Notre Dame also helped produce a brochure and a video that illustrated the issue at hand and told the stories of some of the people impacted by this ban. How important was the element of telling people's stories as you tried to make this case?
Oh, ultimately, I think that's what helped pass the bill. And the reason I say that is the state senator who goes to Indianapolis, because a lot of people don't realize we have U.S. senators and U.S. representatives, and we have state senators and state representatives. And the state representatives and senators go to Indianapolis and make the laws for Indiana. I remember that when I went down for the testimony, the senator who sponsored the bill, he talked about needing this bill because with the opiate epidemic and people were going to be coming out of prison and they would not get a job like today and be paid this coming Friday. So, you know, they would need some food until they got their first paychecks. And he talked about people coming from treatment and, again, needing help with food. And so when I told the story about people who were unable to get food because they couldn't get SNAP, it kind of helped the senators understand how important food is to the process of recovery. I want to add, I'm technologically challenged. So I didn't know how to make a brochure. Mm. I didn't know how to make this iMovie that the students did. And Catalina can tell you all that they just didn't make it, but they wrote it.
They wrote the dialogue. They wrote all the text. What I thought was really valuable for them was that we went to a local radio station in South Bend. And they got to record the text for the video, which is on YouTube, and so overall, it was such a great experience for them because they had never made a video. They had never put together a brochure of this type. And so it was really a great learning experience for them. And I would like to make a comment that I think is important for people to understand about this bill. Before the law was passed, other people that were released from prison, such as any, you know, a violent, very violent offense, people that even had committed murders, could leave prison after having served their sentence, and they were able to get food stamps. So when we started telling people in the community about this, no one was really aware and were shocked that it was only drug offenders that were being targeted for this SNAP law to not apply to apply to them only. And I think that it was absurd, and that really also helped to make the case why just them. And as Cheryl told you, it was because, you know, their rationale was, well, they're going to sell the food stamps to buy drugs.
Well, sure. I want to add something, too, that I think is really important.
Sure.
They didn't just research the bills that other states had passed that allow people to get SNAP, or so what some people call food stamps. They also did something which was go and I told them I needed food pantries because I wanted to write or email to every food pantry asking them to write their legislators in Indianapolis to support the bill. And one of the things they ended up doing was they found that there's a state organization of food pantries. Emily Bryant, it's called, I believe it's Feeding Indiana Hungry or, yes, Feeding Indiana's Hungry. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
And we're going to have a representative from Feeding Indiana's Hungry, the executive director, in the next segment.
Well, I was going to say, when she and I got together, it was really great because she's in Indianapolis. And so she already knew all the legislators because of her lobbying work, which meant she kind of handled that. And then I handled getting like people who are at St. Vincent de Paul, which is a Catholic organization, and many of them have food pantries. And I worked on getting the bishops in Indiana, Catholic bishops, to support the bill. So it was really great, but I would have never met Emily if the students hadn't done the research for the food pantries in the state.
So you get the bill together. During the 2013 session, then State Senator John Brodin, a Democrat from South Bend, presented the bill to lawmakers, but it died in committee without getting a hearing. And then the same thing happened for the next 2 years.
Right.
What were those early years like for you?
They were disappointing, but I'm going to be honest. One of the reasons I kept going was because I saw how people really needed to be going – needed to be able to go in a grocery store and buy them a gallon of milk. Hmm. And plus, I have to be honest, there was a state senator whose name I will not name, but I would kept trying to get a hold of him over and over. And the last day I was down on a Friday, there's a gatekeeper that you talk to if you want to speak to a state senator. His name was Andy, and Andy said, "Cheryl, I have a note from Senator," and then the person's name. And I read, it was on notebook paper. And this senator was really high up in the political party, Republican political party. And he said, "I applaud your efforts, Cheryl, but I will never give this bill a hearing. What would I say to people who can't get food stamps, who've never committed a drug felony, but only were a few dollars over?" And I wrote him back and said, "That's what leadership is." And then I reiterated about how much it costs to keep a person in prison, approximately $21,000 a year. Mm. And if we could keep just two people out, we would be saving money, or actually one person out, we would be saving the state money. And so that kind of challenged me to keep it up.
Got less than a minute left. Did you spend a lot of time at the State House?
I would go down for a week and a half every January to start meeting with senators. In the meantime, I would email them and call them, but I would go down for a week and a half.
And what were you learning about the lawmaking process, that it's long and arduous?
It's long, it's arduous, that you have to know about the senators. So, for instance, for lack of a better word, the students did what I call a dossier on them. Mm-hmm. So I ended up knowing what they did for a living, how many kids they had, what their religion was, what organizations they went to. So as I was writing or emailing them, for instance, if they were Catholic, I would say to the person in Evansville, well, and then the name of the bishop for Evansville is supporting this bill, and here are the reasons why. So I try to tailor it in to kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know.
We'll definitely come back to it. There's a lot more to talk about. And when we'll be back, we'll be joined again by Cheryl Ash, longtime retired librarian and advocate for ex-offenders. We still have Catalina El Arroyo, Associate Director of Undergraduate Studies and Director of Internships at the University of Notre Dame. And when we come back, we'll be joined by the Executive Director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry. And that's in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on how advocates were able to help pass a law that expanded food stamp eligibility to people with prior drug felonies. And we're joined again by retired longtime librarian and advocate for ex-offenders, Cheryl Ash, and Catalina Arroyo, the associate director, I keep getting that wrong, Catalina, of Undergraduate Studies and Director of Internships at the University of Notre Dame. And now we're welcoming Emily Weichert-Bryant, the executive director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry, who also played a major role in advocating for the passage of this law. Emily, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, we would love to hear your questions and comments. We're on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can send us a short voicemail with your name and where you're calling from, 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Emily, can you talk a little bit about the mission of Feeding Indiana's Hungry and your role?
Absolutely. Feeding Indiana's Hungry is the State Association of Feeding America affiliate food banks. We have 11 members. There are 200 across the country. Our job as the state association is to bring them together for advocacy and education purposes, also to provide them with some program support. But a lot of what I spend my time doing as the executive director is the advocacy piece. So spending time at the State House, going to Washington, D.C. on Saturday to talk to federal folks next week about largely the programs, the anti-hunger programs that come from the USDA that serve the over 800,000 Hoosiers at risk of hunger, as well as Americans across the country.
So you spend a lot of time at the State House in your role?
I do, yes.
And what are your objectives then when you're there?
Well, it depends on the year, actually. Sometimes it's a little bit of defense. The last few years, we've been lucky to do some offense working on this particular bill. There was a bill that was passed the session before this that increased the asset limit for SNAP so that a household could have a little bit of savings and still be eligible. And sometimes it's defense, or sometimes it's really explaining these programs. One thing that I've found in experience with the State General Assembly is they don't necessarily understand the nuances of the SNAP program because it is so federally mandated. And the state has a few options, but not a lot. And so it's explaining, here's why I understand your idea. I understand where you're coming from. Here's why that may not work. Mm. But maybe we can come to some common ground and move forward with something useful.
Hundreds of bills are authored every year. But if we just look at last year's legislative session, for example, only a little more than one out of five pieces of legislation became law. Is there a set of criteria that you look for to decide whether or not a bill is worth getting behind? Kind of what you were just talking about.
Sure.
Sometimes there are things you need to look at.
Yeah, a lot of years it's what do we have time to do proactively if we've got too much to do reactively.
But what's the first step?
The first step is to figure out what kind of critical mass we can get to work on it.
But regarding the issue, I guess, is that part of the challenge then, finding, okay, if we want to get this far, what's the first step? What's maybe the first thing we can put in front of lawmakers that might get things where we want them to be in maybe, say, a few years?
Exactly the sort of thing that Cheryl and her folks were doing, reaching out to legislators and saying, mm-hmm. would you be willing to file this bill?
Yeah.
That's the first step. And from there, you can start coalition building, educating, and really moving things forward.
When you when did Cheryl's work come to your attention?
So I looked back about 10 years through bills. And it looks like Senator Brodin started filing something along these lines in 2010. I had just started in this position, and really at that point we were trying to beat back a lot of things rather than working proactively. I believe we met Cheryl through Senator Brodin in about 2003 or 2004. And started really working in coalition and bringing in other partners. What Cheryl has that I don't have are access to clients, people who are seeing this, who are living this. And not having that actual human touch is often detrimental when you're trying to advocate on a policy. I can give you numbers. I can give you program reasons and rationale. But if I'm not talking to someone from a constituent perspective or from a lived experience, it's a lot harder to make change.
Cheryl, we started talking about this a little bit in the last segment. In the years that you spent trying to advocate for this bill, what did Emily bring to the table that really helped get it past the goal line?
The legislators would talk to her. I'm going to be honest. Most of them wouldn't really talk to me, the legislators. I mostly talked to their assistants. But Emily had credibility with them. And she bought that. And she said, I could rally people in various churches to write or call their legislators. I could get clubs to do that. I could come up with people who would affect it. But it doesn't really do any good if you can't actually get to the legislators. And Emily was able to do that.
Emily, she said you had credibility. Was this from your just experience as a lawmaker? You just knew how to talk to them?
Well, I hadn't been a lawmaker. I had been on Senate staff for about 9 sessions before I started this job. So some of them I knew. A lot of what we've been trying to do with our organization since we were founded in 2005 is to become that resource for policymakers to be able to say, we understand the programs. We understand how this impacts your constituents. We hope you'll trust us as a resource.
I guess instead of lawmaker, I meant to say lobbyer. So is that something you've done? You've done that before because that's what you are?
Well, I'm the executive director, but advocacy follows under my hat as well. So for state purposes, I'm a registered lobbyist because we spend more than $500 a year of my salary.
Gotcha.
To spend that time talking to legislators.
And Cheryl talked about learning lobbying 101 through this process over the last 6 years. And when you were working to forward this bill, how did you get support? Who was important to have on board?
One of the things that we found was having bipartisan support on the bill. So Senator Brodin carried it the first year that we really pushed it.
And Democrat.
A Democrat. And the first year that it had a hearing, it was his bill. The next 2 years, in 17 and 18, it was a Republican. In 2017, Senator Merrick carried the bill for us as part of his opiate epidemic response, because when we're looking at drug felonies, in many cases, there may have been an addiction that went with it. And in 2018, when the bill passed, it started out as Senator Bohatchik's bill and ended up in Representative Clear's bill. And both of them had been involved in the same sort of thing. But really what helped us push forward and get access not just to those two members but to a number of legislators, it wasn't just me. We had a coalition by the time this passed of 35 different groups. Religious groups, health groups, housing, hunger, retail, domestic violence. The Indy Chamber was involved. Recycle Force, which is a fantastic group here in town that only employ folks with felony convictions. Making sure that we were bringing things in from all perspectives, because with legislators, it's not just, is this a good idea or a bad idea? They're all coming to it from a different perspective. So how do you meet them where they are? And so when you've got a Rolodex of 35 organizations and totally different viewpoints, you pull from what's going to work with them.
Cheryl, how much of a difference in momentum did you feel when you finally got Republicans on board?
Well, I think that was the major key. But I also think what was happening is that the opiate epidemic hit rural areas first, and it hit it hard. And so suddenly I think they were beginning to hear about their constituents in the rural areas and all who needed help coming back from prison, coming back from treatment. And I think as they began to understand this, they realized it wasn't just an urban problem. You know, I always say drug addiction is an equal opportunity destroyer. And so it suddenly had a face to it for many of the rural legislators. And I think that's why it made it so they were able to vote for the bill. And at the same time, it solved some of the problems. And this is where Emily was really instrumental. They were all worried about people using drugs and all while they were getting the food stamps. So Emily came up with the idea of people who have drug felonies and are on probation or parole are always being tested anyway. So Emily was able to help the legislators understand these people are being tested already. And she can explain how they tied this in that I guess made the legislators comfortable to vote yes on the bill.
Cheryl Ash is a retired longtime librarian and advocate for ex-offenders. Today we're talking about a change in the law that went into effect last month that allows for certain drug offenders to that gives them eligibility for SNAP benefits, so-called food stamps. We're also joined by Catalina Arroyo, the assistant director of associate director of undergraduate studies and director of internships at the University of Notre Dame. And we also have Emily Weichert Bryant, the executive director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry, with us. So, Cheryl, Senate Bill number 9 was signed by Governor Holcomb during the 2018 legislative session, went into effect on January 1st of this year. Who is now eligible for SNAP benefits, and are there any conditions?
Well, the person who had a drug felony, if say their drug felony is in the past, they're not on probation or parole, they simply go fill out the application. They're mailed a piece of paper that asks them basically have they completed parole and probation, and they check yes. Then next what happens is if they're on parole and probation, as long as they don't violate their probation and parole, they can get food stamps. The only person who can't get food stamps is a person who is in violation of parole and probation. They can't get food stamps. And to be perfectly honest, I've worked with people who are violated. They're not going to go apply for food stamps because they don't want the probation officer to know where they're living.
Mm. Catalina, how does it feel to see something that you and your students worked on actually come to fruition, become a law?
Needless to say, it feels great. it was such a long process, and we had so many rejections no matter what our argument was. It was very frustrating at times. And I have to admit, I just thought this is just never going to happen in Indiana. The other, I think, to think about is that I'm sure that at the beginning that this law had such support, the old law had such support because it was, I'm sure, connected to the war on drugs. And now, as we're learning more and more about addiction and seeing it more as an illness, and as Cheryl mentioned, that the rural areas were so affected by the opioid crisis, that just started making our legislators think more seriously about this and how it was affecting their constituents. But to answer your question again, it feels fantastic. But I have to give Cheryl and Emily really the credit, because Cheryl is relentless, and she didn't care how many no's she got. She didn't care if another problem popped up. It was okay. Then we're going to look at it. We're going to move forward. So she's really the one that deserves the credit for this, as well as Emily, because of her influence in Indy.
A team effort for sure. Emily, do people who were ineligible know that they're now eligible, or is there a lot of communication and education yet to be done?
I think it's a combination of both. For the households that FSSA already knew had someone in a mixed status household where they had an individual with a felony who was not eligible, they sent out letters in advance to that population the end of last year. There has been some public awareness done. Cheryl's been doing it up in South Bend. I'm sure how you saw this in the first place. We've done some press. We've sent out, pushed out some flyers that the Indiana Legal Services Incorporated had put out about how to go about the process to our food banks. And our food banks work with about 1,700 pantries across the state in providing them food, but also providing them information and resources on SNAP. So I think it's a learning process. And I think the more we're able to talk about it and normalize it, the more people will be aware.
For people who are interested in reforming a law or making a change like this, what do they need to know? What do people need to know about the process?
Be patient. It takes time. Always would be the first advice.
This started in 2013. This process. Well, no, being before that,
The bill started being filed in 2010. It finally started moving in 2016. And it took 3 years from that point. The first year it passed the Senate, died in the House. The first year we worked on it, it didn't get a hearing. Second year it died in the House. The third year it died in the House. And the fourth year the bill died in the House and we put the language somewhere else. So it actually came through. It was House Bill 1317 that the language actually became law in. So don't expect change overnight. Bring as many people to the table with different viewpoints and perspectives and experiences as you can. Make sure that you're talking to your legislator as a constituent, but make sure that a lot more people are talking to their legislators as well.
We have an addendum to some comments that Catalina made a second ago. Renee on Facebook says, Cheryl Ash has improved our community by working tirelessly to represent common people. Cheryl, how does a comment like that make you feel?
Well, it makes me feel good, but I have to be honest. After my picture was in the paper, Sunday I got $100 from a lady I have never met. She realized what had happened and told me, here's $100, do whatever you want with it. And I was able to buy a person some eyeglasses and a bike. They need to go for work.
You made that $100 go pretty far. I know one purse that can cost that much. Not that I do a lot of time buying purses. But Cheryl, do people who are looking to change the law come to you for advice since this has happened? Have you
gotten
any phone calls?
Yeah, actually. I'm getting emails or phone calls from people, and they'll say, I saw your thing in the paper, and I want this law changed, and how do I do it? So what I kind of do is I walk them through what I did. I said, well, first off, you need to, you know, read what the law is. You need to research why the law was made. Then I say, look at what other states have done around a similar law. I tell them from there, then they need to start what I thought the students did for me with my little dossier on the legislators. So they need to research the legislators, and I tell them how they can do that, you know, where you can find research about the legislators. Then I tell them you need to see who else might be interested in this bill. And I really explain to them. I'm working with a lady now, and she contacted me in November. No, she contacted me in October, and I told her, don't plan on putting this bill in this year. And I listed the kind of research she had to do, and I'm helping her with some of the research.
Because now you know the process. Now you know how long it takes.
Right.
Cheryl Ash is a retired longtime librarian and advocate for ex-offenders. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks for your advocacy.
Thank you.
Our thanks as well to Catalina Arroyo, Associate Director of Undergraduate Studies and Director of Internships at the University of Notre Dame. Thanks, Catalina.
Thank you.
And Executive Director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry, Emily Weichert-Bryant, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, it's wherever you find your podcast. Tomorrow, we'll broadcast our first on-location panel. Last week, the All In team traveled to Evansville to host a listener-driven conversation on healthcare. That'll be tomorrow at this time. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.